thanks very much for the chance to speak with the very freewheeling topic, Reflections of Teacher Researchers, because it's, as you've seen already, given us a great deal of scope for what we want to say. The 16 participants in Centre 07 were all Certificate 1 students. And effectively, they represented the enormous diversity of AMEP students. Among them was a young Brazilian. Ah, I should be putting this actually on here. This is what I'm doing. A young Brazilian engineer, Certificate 1, newly arrived, balking at the realising the distance he had to travel between where he was with his English and becoming a professional engineer. Another was a matriarch from the Democratic Republic of Congo, holding together the remnants of her extended family, believing she could do nothing in Australia, even though for the previous 10 years in Uganda she'd taken on the responsibility of ensuring that the elderly people in the refugee camp got their entitlement to food and water every day. There was a self-effacing young Burundian guy who somewhere in the long transit from Burundi to Australia had identified what an electronic engineer did. And despite his interrupted education, he resolved that's what he wanted to do. So, to everybody's astonishment, not only did he finish his AMEP hours, he went on to enrol in LLMP and a first year mainstream TAFE course in the building industry. And to do that, he had to travel 2 hours each way, each day, 4 days a week and 2 nights a week. And this was his determined response. Then, there was the Huiga ice skating champion, a single father with a teenage daughter, despairing that he could ever learn English. Especially, he hadn't a car and he didn't have the resources to do it. He joined the EPP program and unfortunately missed out because he didn't have a car on getting employment, and so the journey was still going on. But he was very studious and he was very determined to try to learn. There was the well-to-do Korean musician who, with her daughters, decided to open a gourmet food business in Adelaide. And we watched her demeanour and her appearance change dramatically over the quarterly interviews as this goal became much closer. And what about the quiet Serbian guy who, with his teenage son, between them held down 3 cleaning jobs? English class was a place, as many of the Serbian guys have experienced, of being a very restless place. But he knew it was where he had to be to get enough English to begin to build a future for them both. And like so many other people who've had Chinese students, we had several, but one in particular was a Vietnamese-born Taiwanese marriage broker who carried the same studious and text-based learning process and who was struggling to learn to speak. And as a final thought, there were the 2 Iraqi brothers. One gregarious, outgoing, confident, tall and strong, self-assured. The other, quite the opposite, less confident, wondering whether his capacity to learn was maybe because of the weather, maybe the neighbour's dogs, or maybe it was the car bomb. Which other RTO across Australia or in the world would accept as its students people of such diversity whose only course, whose only prerequisite was their desire to learn the main language of their new country. From the time the project was first mooted, I was really keen to participate in it if I could, because I've always valued the work of the AMEP Research Centre for 100 years, and being felt of it for it, and being sustained professionally as a teacher, and it bound us as a unique and responsive and flexible and internationally respected organisation. I think perhaps those of us living in the regions, as I have in Hobart and in Adelaide, I think we appreciate that unification much more even than perhaps some folk in Sydney and Melbourne do. I don't know, but I've certainly found it very significant. I'd just like to remind you, though, that the NSELTA began in the building where I work in Adelaide way back in the 1980s. A national longitudinal project exploring the core business of the AMEP was also long overdue. So congratulations again to all those terrific people who recognised the need and committed themselves to making it a reality, who resourced the project, who recruited both academic researchers and those of us at the coalface, the teachers. And from day one, we were set an overwhelming agenda, ambitious timelines, a mountain of data to collect, a sense that the whole future of the AMEP might be at stake. And then, given the chance to be involved, however, I was really committed to ensuring that our final report reflects the diversity of the AMEP clients, from pre-literate learners to Certificate 3, skilled and family reunion migrants and refugees on humanitarian visas, men and women, in a range of ages and stages, their proximity to employment, the nature of their community relationships. I really did fear that we were at risk of disenfranchising the less proficient. And it certainly was hard and more expensive, of course, because we had to hire interpreters to make sure that the voices of the pre-literate and the Cert 1 people were heard. However, I'm really proud to say that of our 16 people in Centre 7, there was a remarkable balance in the profile of the students. We had an equal number of men and women, right, as opposed to the main overall. We had 8 of each. We had 8 skilled migrants, family reunion people, and 8 refugee humanitarian visa people. 13 of the 16 were focused on work at Cert 1 level, and the other 3 were preoccupied either with new babies or orphaned grandchildren. 9 of the 16 took up some kind of employment even before finishing Cert 1. Now, in a way that's good, in a way that's bad. It's a point of concern. It most noticeably affected their attendance. And 2 had to withdraw long term because of their business priorities. 1 lost a third of her entitlement because she had to start at 10 o'clock every day, having worked a 3-hour shift beforehand, and we couldn't retrieve those hours, and that was very frustrating. And of the others, there were a couple who had to withdraw, one from breast cancer, one from pregnancy complications. Several completed their full entitlement, including 2 who participated in a new EPP program. 1 ran out of her precious entitlement, including SPP. She'd started as a pre-literate learner with no English, lots of oracy, but no literacy. And she didn't finish Cert 1, and now she's somewhere in that black hole where learning momentum is lost, and formal and ongoing learning opportunities for adults with minimal schooling and no L1 literacy in post-AMEP environments are virtually non-existent. Methodologies. I confess to having been a stranger to ethnographic methodology before we started, and for much of the process I actually felt quite rudderless because I wasn't familiar with where we were going. I was grateful, though, very much for Kerry Taylor-Leach, who's currently in East Timor, as we've mentioned. She was my academic researcher, and for her confidence. But it seemed to me that free-flowing interviews could hardly produce quantifiable tables and ensure consistency in national results. However, I'm coming out of you that in fact it's produced a whole different range of data, and as we've seen from the colleagues who've presented. But I was still niggling about this a bit, and it was after the data collection was over that I came across a reference, phew, which actually gave me, in retrospect, a kind of basis to understand what we were doing. And it was a research report from Professor Nicholas Proctor, who works at the University of South Australia, someone I actually called in years ago to come and address our students, our staff, actually, at the height of the Balkan conflict. And he was a mental nurse educator and was able to give a lot of information, background information on torture and trauma to our staff. But he had produced in 2003 a study called Reciprocity in Education, a model of interactive learning between migrant communities and mental health, mainstream mental health workers. And he described this project as crossing intersubjective boundaries to explore dimensions of culture and mental health. Well, like Proctor's researchers, mainstream mental health service providers they were, and we had many cultural and linguistic boundaries to explore. Dimensions of culture and our students' self-evaluation of themselves as second language learners. And simultaneously, we had to negotiate a range of many other relationships in and outside of the classroom, entering participants' homes, as Elsie said, workplaces, sharing their class excursions, explaining ourselves to third parties like church leaders and participants, work colleagues and Chinese massage shops and staff in aged care facilities and spouses and daughters and sisters and community members. There were lots of people to whom we had to explain ourselves. And like Proctor's research, ours was a two-way reciprocal process. Like his research team, we were engaged in a form of educational interaction that made use of different perceptions and values and beliefs. In our case, of course, it was language learning and the experience of language learning. But sometimes I've wondered about how wise is it to assume that our learners know what they're doing, or that they in fact are ethnographically equipped themselves, that they're self-aware or capable observers of themselves as language learners. I think we've all had an experience of sitting in a class with students or asking them, or realising, I suppose, that it's they've never been asked to reflect on their learning strategies. Or their learning style, or their preferences, or their habits. They're very complex questions. And I'm sure there are many, many students who've never... I asked my students, did you ever imagine you'd be sitting next to people from 5 or 6 or 18 different countries in the world when you come to learn English? And the answer is no. I was focusing on myself, of course, and naturally that's the situation. However, I thought, oh well, I'd better go back and look at the observations and see the evidence of self-awareness. So I, in fact, did find people discovering that learning a literate language was highly different, a different proposition to simply adding a fourth or a fifth oral language to their repertoire. I learned that people recognised the distance of how far they had to travel to become professional in their own in a new language. And I saw the trepidation and the frustration and the anger that often provoked. There were others who recognised that their dissatisfaction with their personal performance in the formal classroom or out of classroom settings, or trying to make sense of why this might be so, struggling to accept the trauma, the family relationship breakdowns, ignorance about sources of assistance, and even their rights under the law might all be contributing factors. On the other hand, self-awareness can provoke some less optimistic attitudes. Sasha believed he was too old. Rose believed she couldn't do anything in Australia. Jake admitted that his business responsibilities meant he couldn't put serious attention to English language learning. Jane was too preoccupied with the secondary, her son's secondary education, and in a sense was avoiding having to come back to class. So much of this self-awareness could be linked with one of the new metaphors that are being applied to learners of second language. Being in a place called in-betweenness. And I'd like to acknowledge that Kerry's found this research, and it's very new, it would seem. It comes originally from a professor of an Indian guy who's a professor of English literature at Harvard, and Homi Bhabha, his name is, and he contemplated the post-colonial world. The concept is being applied even as we speak. Next week, I think in early December, there's a woman from Hawaii giving a paper in Auckland on this whole idea of participation, acquisition, or in-betweenness as a metaphor for becoming acquiring language. So it's very, very contemporary. And some of you might know a woman called Lupia Sarug, who worked with in Nebraska with some Yemeni girls and watched how they changed their relationship into different texts at different stages of their lives. She saw themselves playing in two communities, their secular American school environment and their ethnic community shaped by the expectations of Islam. At its core, in-betweenness suggests that learners adapt their performance and identity according to the textual or social, cultural or physical surrounds that they find themselves in. Now, I realised that Kerry and I, as academic and teacher researchers, we were doing the same thing. Neither of us were the students' regular teachers, therefore Kerry and I were strangers, and we had to adapt to the students' frameworks by explaining our alignment with the local AMEP provider and the wider institutional goals and links and so on. This relationship of stranger to student, in fact, this in-betweenness, made it easier for us to elicit and the students to express criticism or misgivings. But to be truthful, I found this in-betweenness quite difficult. Quite a change from being a teacher to being a teacher researcher. And I squirm a bit as I recall the interview recordings, and I thank the patient transcribers for putting up with my interviews, actually. There were multiple times when I reverted to being simply teacher, not teacher, but researcher. And we'd grab a paper and we'd explain a grammatical point, for example. Or I'd become a settlement officer and I'd explain gender equality in Australian marriage law. Or I'd become a student counsellor and I'd explain about learner pathways. Or I'd become an amateur psychologist, exploring that student's fear about dogs. Or an off-screen conversationalist, exploring a student, merely an adult peer having an adult conversation, discussing the opening ceremony of the Beijing Olympics, of course, with the skater, or the drought, or my recent journey to Cambodia. And all this had a lot to do with wanting to relate to students in an adult conversation, and of course was made possible mostly by having interpreters on hand. But in fact, we were participating in a reciprocal relationship. I'm not sure how professional that was, but it was an opportunity for equity. After all, we were conducting relatively free-ranging interviews that were unstructured, exploratory, and so on. And the project required that we probe for details about the students' lives outside as well as inside the class, that we try to find the self behind the language barrier. It was an exquisite opportunity, I recall now, I reflect, to counter the deficit view that so often we bring to our relationship with our students. And there's one report from the very first edition of Applied Linguistics in 1980 by Peter Harder. He wrote a paper called where he explored the reduced personality of the second language learner. And it seemed to me that here was an opportunity to get behind that and to see that we were sharing an in-between sort of space. So, what about memos? If I was writing a memo to you all in reflecting about my experience, I've talked about these two ideas, reciprocity and in-betweenness. Reciprocity is quite easy to understand, but it's something our professional training permits us to do only within certain limits. But here's my first memo. Let's be inquiring and curious teachers. Let's concede that there's much more than meets the eye to every student that we have the privilege of getting to know and of teaching. How different our curriculum might be and the learning outcomes could be quite different, and also if we could allocate the means and the time to discover each other better. By exercising reciprocity, it also challenges the standard benchmarks of settlement success that we've been hearing about with the LSIA studies and so on. Language proficiency and health and employment and social networks, house ownership and so on. Social inclusion has probably replaced access and equity, have they, as the mantra in Australian values? But a one-size-fits-all doesn't always deliver either. So, a second MIMO has evidence of reciprocity. Let's protect the flexibility of the ANEP in direct response to the diversity of our kinds. Continue to fine-tune the opportunities that we offer in response to the changing needs of the students and the wider society. In between this is a bit more complex. Can I just explain? There's a word called interstitial, which I had to go to my husband to find out what it means, as well as the Macquarie Dictionary. But it refers to the gap between cells, or the gap between crystals. And this is all part of this idea of in-betweenness, and I was a little concerned about the microscopic dimensions of it. But then I was struck also by the wholesomeness of it, or the all-encompassing nature of it. And it's something that we could perhaps work out a bit more. There may be, the students may be in between cultures and texts and social relationships, some vastly different to each other, some quite similar, but it's this pervasive and wholly surrounding image which is most useful. Will they always be in this position? If we break the seal, what happens to the whole organism? But Sarup said that in-betweenness signified the immediate adaptation of one's performance or identity to one's textual or social or cultural or physical surroundings, and it's not a fixed state. So what this analogy does is challenge the ingrained view that our students come to us in deficit. We tell them they've come because they need functional English to operate in this society. But an alternative is to acknowledge our respective positions of in-betweenness and learn to say two little words, which I've learned from one of my colleagues in my next door office. Even though, she says, I discovered this was rather helpful. She says to her students when she does relationships counselling in her second job, even though my situation is difficult, I can still. So even though my expression of myself is currently limited, I can still be an active participant in my community. So what's in the MIMO to our students? I'm prepared to, I think we should say to them, even though we have very different cultures or languages or expectations, I'm prepared to adapt my curriculum to your needs, to maintain flexibility in our delivery, which gives you access to your entitlement and provides you with a safe and reliable space where we can adapt together. And that's why I'm so grateful to have been part of this project, because that's what the research question has been about, probing what happens in that in-between space for both students and teachers in order for our organisation to reciprocate with relevant and meaningful programmes. Not only for our language curriculum, but also by resourcing our students' settlement relationships in and out of class. So my final MIMO, world peace, yes, but please, let's commit our nation's resources to continuing and extending this task. Thank you.